We are back to continue our discussion of René Descartes' philosophy. And we left off last time where he had given us a proof that God exists and a proof that normal sense perception reveals the world as it is to us. He goes on then to argue for other points that he considers really crucial and important in his philosophy. And the first has to do with humans. He gives us another argument. Number one, the human mind is a thinking thing. That cannot be doubted. Premise one. And why can't it be doubted? Because if you doubt it, you're performing an action, and you have to exist to perform that action. That's the cogito ergo sum argument again. Wait till you see the rest of this now. Physical bodies in space can be doubted. Therefore, mind and body are two exclusively distinct realities. Minds are not in space, and bodies cannot think. Of course, that also includes they can't will, perceive, feel, doubt, believe, and all other mental activities. Short argument, mighty powerful conclusion, far-reaching conclusion. The mind's a thinking thing, we can't doubt that. We can doubt physical bodies in space. Therefore, these two things have to be completely separate. Distinct. When he says exclusively distinct, what he means is whatever is true of the one is not true of the other. Ooh, that's a very far-reaching conclusion. And it's argued on very slender grounds. Two short premises. And let's look at premise two again. Physical bodies in space can be doubted. Minds can't be doubted. So they have to be something different. Not only distinct realities from one another, but utterly different, so that whatever is true of one is not true of the other. I don't think this comes within miles of proving that. Consider premise two. See what's wrong with this. He's basing it on whether we can doubt something or not. Now suppose there's a bush in my front yard, and I walk past it every time I go in or out of my house. And suppose, too, that it's a very dark Halloween night, and I become somewhat confused. Maybe I had one cider too many or something, but I'm wondering, I think I go out the back door, when in fact I went out the front door. And as I pass this bush, its stickers grab onto my arm, and I become terrified. I think some weird creature has grabbed at me. That could happen. It's possible. But in that case, I would be terrified of this bush. I would be terrified of what is really a bush because I thought it was something else. And that's what Descartes' argument doesn't allow for. You see, I cannot doubt my mind. But physical bodies can be doubted. But maybe minds are physical bodies too, and we just don't know that. We've made a mistake. So, in the light of one understanding, we can't doubt them. But then, when we see them from another point of view, we mistake what we're talking about and think we can doubt it. I would never say to anybody about my house and the bush in the front yard, I'm scared to death of that bush. No, I'd laugh at them and say, what do you mean? What do I have to be scared about? It's just nothing but a dumb bush. Well, but if on a dark Halloween night and I think I've walked out the back door instead of the front, I can be terrified by what is in fact the bush, by not knowing that it is in fact the bush. That's what this argument does not allow for. Our attitudes towards something don't discriminate the somethings, don't tell us what those are like. They only tell us what we think they're like. So it could very well be that what we think are physical objects are all minds, or what we think is a non-physical mind is actually a physical mind. In other words, Descartes thinks is a non-physical mind is actually the physical brain. That we can doubt. In which case, this conclusion doesn't follow. And it certainly doesn't follow that if there are two things and they're not the same identical thing, that whatever is true of one is false of the other. He's shown us at most one property being able to be doubted that can properly be said of one and not the other. But how does he get from that to anything true of the one isn't true of the other? And that's what he's pushing at us. Therefore, mind and body are two exclusively distinct realities. Minds are not in space. They're not, huh? Doesn't it seem to you that certain minds in one place have a certain idea and keep it a secret from other minds that are in another place, so that some minds over here know this secret and minds over there don't? Doesn't that mean that the minds and the idea are in space? If something's known in one space and not in another? In other words, if this were true, there'd be no such thing as a secret held by real people who exist in different spaces. He'd say just their bodies do, not their minds. Oh, but if the minds aren't in different spaces, why would their geography make any difference to what's known? He gives two more proofs. I want you to see these. One. One, whatever is in space cannot, I'm sorry, whatever is not, I meant to say, in space cannot have parts. Whatever has no parts cannot be destroyed. The mind is not in space. Therefore, the mind cannot be destroyed. And is naturally immortal. My apologies, I thought I had switched you to the blackboard and you were following the writing. Whatever is not in space cannot have parts. That's premise one. Premise two, whatever has no parts cannot be destroyed. And premise three, the mind is not in space. He thinks he's already shown that by the previous argument. So now he draws the conclusion, the mind cannot be destroyed and is naturally immortal, because it has no parts, and it can't be, therefore, disintegrate, fall apart. He thinks that's the only way something could be destroyed. Now, it's sometimes hard to know where to start when something seems so blatantly wrong, but let me just say this. At one time, when Christ was talking with his disciples, he told them, you don't fear men and their threats. The proper fear should be of God, because he has the power to destroy both body and soul. He didn't say God was going to. In fact, God, as we know, whole effort is to rescue people and not have them be destroyed. But Jesus affirmed that he could. God has the power. Why can't God poof annihilate something if he wants to? And the answer is there is no reason why he couldn't. So I find this argument to fall flat. You and I can't destroy something if it has no parts, because for us, destroying it means knocking it into parts. It doesn't follow that God can. So I don't like this argument at all. And then, of course, I don't particularly care for the argument that the mind's not in space. I reject that too. I think minds are in space. And I think there are such things as minds. And I don't think that there is nothing in our heads but a brain. We have brains. And they're involved in the knowing and perceiving process. They're involved in belief. But they ain't the whole story. We also have something called a mind. In popular language, it's called a soul. So what's going on here? I mean, why is he going out on a limb like this and trying to make us believe that these very weighty conclusions follow from very simple, quick couple of premises? What's the back of this? I think I know, or I wouldn't have asked that. I'll tell you what I think. What Descartes has in mind in back of all this is a very sharp controversy over whether people have freedom or they are determined in their beliefs and actions. Determinism means that whatever you think the cause is, doesn't matter. It could be how your brain's configured, or how your DNA is configured, or how you were potty trained. It doesn't matter what the cause is. These causes accumulate. They actually force you to believe what you believe, think what you think, do what you do. That's determinism. The free will position is we not only have a body, and not only is it the case that many influential forces impinge on it, we have a DNA structure, we are influenced by our upbringing, and so on, the culture around us. But still, push comes to shove, we don't have to do A rather than B. We have the freedom in that moment to say, no, I'm going to do B. I don't care what anybody says or what anybody likes. Determinism, again, is a theory that every single thought, choice, belief, and action is forced on us by forces and influences, by causes that are not our own, that were outside of us and existed before us. We're the products of those causes. And the free will position is, however much we may, in whatever respects we may be forced in some ways, nevertheless, we really have complete freedom when it comes to our choices and to our thoughts and to our judgments. Now, the view that people have free will is what's assumed by the law everywhere that people live. We make certain things crimes because they're wicked. And then we say to somebody who breaks that law, you had the choice whether to murder that person or not, and you chose to do it. So you're responsible for your choice, and you're going to be punished for it. A determinist, to be consistent, should say those people should not be punished for it as though it was something they could have avoided. They couldn't have avoided it, but since they have such a nature that it determines them, it forces them to kill another person, we should lock them up, not to punish them or reform them, but so that they can't get to more people and kill them. So the determinist says we should segregate those people from the rest of society, but not blame them, because they are not blameworthy. They did nothing to be the way they are, and they didn't have the freedom to choose to be different. Now, clearly, I think it seems to me, clearly, the Christian religion and its sacred writings, which are our sources for it, the scriptures, everywhere assume that people do have free will. When God addresses different people and they say and do what they how they respond, he is sometimes delighted and sometimes enraged. He treats people as though they really have the choice whether to obey him or not. There are some things we're not free about, that's true. But freedom, whether to do good or evil, we are free to choose. And that's why God rewards and punishes with respect to what we do, good or evil. In fact, now that I'm on that topic, let me add something. I'm assuming that the vast majority of people who are viewing this are Christians. And what I want to add there is that with respect to the final judgment of God, of the whole human race, the way the scriptures describe that judgment is to say, and every human will be judged according to his works, whether they are good or evil. No scripture says we'll be judged for whether we believed in God through Christ. Those who do not believe that were not given that grace by God, and he doesn't hold them responsible for it. But he does hold them responsible for what they had the freedom to do differently, and that's whether they did good or evil. The judgment, then, is moral. I'm not going to get too sidetracked here. The theology is a fascinating sidetrack, but we're not going there. Descartes is trying to defend free will. That's what's going on. That's why we get these stretches, these arguments with dinky little premises that are questionable anyway, and huge momentous conclusions. What he's trying to do is defend free will against determinism. So here's what Descartes has in the back of his head. He's thinking about the way physics is progressing, and how the more we investigate the world, the more laws we find hold in it. In other words, the less and less it looks as though the world around us is free to be one way or another. It looks less and less that it is. It's determined by laws. There are fixed laws in physics. Nothing that we know of in physics is an exception, unless God does a miracle. Okay? What the heck's going on then? What's going on is humans, who always assumed they had free will, assumed they were free to investigate the world. And the more they investigate the world, the more they find there are laws that show that more and more and more things are not free, and they're worried about themselves. They don't want the conclusion, I am determined too. I am like just another atom in the universe, and I do whatever the forces before me made it impossible for me not to do. And he wants to say, therefore, the mind is not physical, so it's not subject to physical laws. The mind is nowhere in space. The mind is not impacted by all the causalities that we can find in the universe and explain, because it ain't there in the universe. It's not in space. It's in time, but not space. And it's not subject to physical laws. It has its own internal laws. And those laws are logical and mathematical, and they include axioms like the principle of sufficient reason, stuff like that. And minds are free to make the choices they want to make. That's why we're responsible. He wants to keep freedom and responsibility. Human responsibility. We are to be held responsible for what we do and what we say and what we think and believe and so on. Okay, I think that theme of free will versus determinism is a big cloud that hangs in the back over all the thinkers of this period. They're all worried about that. And all of them, except the materialists, want to say humans have a mind, call it soul, anything you want, but there's something about a human that's not physical and not subject to physical laws and therefore not determined in what it does. And that, I think, they had right. They didn't always give good arguments for it. To my mind, the best argument for it is this. If someone purports to be a determinist, and they say to you, I think all our thoughts and actions, all our choices, are all determined by the Big Bang, by how the universe started out, the initial explosion of matter and energy and how it congealed made it inevitable that you and I would have this conversation and that I'd say to you what I'm saying now. In that case, there is no rational belief. There is nothing anybody believes for good reasons. Why? Because the determinist has to include himself as something that gets determined. In other words, it was determined by the Big Bang that he would be a determinist. So he's not believing that for good reasons and evidence. He's believing that because he's forced to. So his argument in favor of determinism isn't the real reason he's a determinist. Whatever arguments he can give, he was just forced to think they look good. If there's to be any rational judgment about any conclusion, about anything in philosophy or science, then there has to be freedom to make that judgment. It has to be an unforced judgment made for reasons, not the result of physically determining somebody so that they can't help themselves and they hold this belief rather than that. That's not rational choice. And it's not philosophy, and it's not science. Philosophy and science continue to assume that when people make discoveries and they uncover new laws and so on, that they have the freedom to do that. They aren't being forced to some conclusion. It's not the case that we're going to dig around the world and sooner or later we're going to come up with a rock, and everybody that confronts that rock's going to be forced to believe that it's in fact a crocodile. Could be, according to determinism. In other words, it's a position that's internally incoherent. Anybody who holds that position and gives reasons for it is assuming that he's free to come to that conclusion for those reasons, and that's inconsistent with the determinism. And that, I think, is the best reason for not being one. That and the fact that Scripture, as far as I'm concerned, treats humans as though they have free will. So I regard it also as a revealed truth. There doesn't have to be a verse that says, and God gave all humans free will. All there has to be is story after story of God's encounter with humans that assume that they have free will and hold them responsible for the evil they do and the good that they do. So I would have regarded that as a revealed truth and not tried to give a proof of it. But Descartes trying to proceed step by step and give you logical arguments for each point that he's making. And he thinks now that what he's shown is that humans have a mind. The mind can't be physical. It's not subject to laws. It's not subject to causality. Well, that sounds wrong, but it's not determined by it. That sounds right. But not affected at all? How do you get that? Human minds don't progress. They don't grow with the growth of the brain. They don't need nourishment. And he's saying, no, that's all true of the physical brain, not the mind. That's the way you handle it. This is the view that later on in the 20th century, the British philosopher Gilbert Ryle called the theory of the ghost in the machine. There's a ghostly something that's not physical that inhabits a body that is purely mechanical. And the ghost operates the mechanical body. Yeah. Well, I guess it's easy to make fun of any position. You can always think of clever jokes about it, but I think there are big faults here, but in the main, what Descartes is trying to defend are largely Christian beliefs that are true. And last time I began by reviewing as far as we had come, and there was a point that I didn't review. And now is as good a time as any to bring that up. I last time talked about the idea of a Christian philosophy. I'm sorry, in my first couple of lectures I talked about that. And I said that as non-Christians invented philosophy and theory making and science, what they did was search the cosmos for the reality that is the divine reality, that is the part of the cosmos that did not come into being, does not pass away, that has unconditional non-dependence. And since that's a mouthful, I told you that I use the shortcut expression self-existent. What is it that's the self-existent part that all the rest depends on? Okay? And that also, ladies and gentlemen, is at the heart of religion. Religion is about identifying the self-existent reality that has generated everything else and coming to stand in right relation to that reality. That's a divinity belief. No matter what you put in that slot, it's either God or it's your God substitute. But it's a religious belief because it regards it as divine. Divine means self-existent. All right, so we look at this and we looked at all the different proposals. Some people said that, oh, you know what, the right description of this is that it's earth. No, it's air. No, it's fire. No, it's water. And among the ancient pagan Greeks, by the 500 BC, we get, no, it's little thingies called atoms. And we get the Pythagoreans saying, no, it's numbers. And we have Plato saying, no, it's a realm of perfections. And so on. We get a lot of different theories. And I said to you that when early Christians looked at this, they rightfully said, these are all God substitutes. We can't say that. These are all to be rejected. No part of the world is the self-existent part that all the rest do. Nothing in the universe, nothing in the created cosmos is self-existent. That's only God. Right on. Exactly. Only God. But they thought maybe there's a piece of the pie which, while not self-existent, was still what hangs all created reality together. See, the pagans had made their choice be both. It was both divine and it was what made everything hang together. It explained how the relationships are possible between all different sorts of things in the world and the network of laws that might explain causal pathways that all going to stem from their choice. So early Christians, thinkers, looked at this and said, well, it's not a self-existent creator, but it still could be what hangs everything together. And so they had a Christian version for any possible philosophy. Take the pagan's idea of what's divine, deny it's divine, and say it depends on God, but then it is what hangs all the cosmos together, not God. God doesn't do it directly, God does it indirectly. Now, the term that came to be used for this reality is the term substance. This can literally be taken apart to see what it means. Sub means under. And stance refers to something that stands. And we use in epistemology, when we're talking about knowledge, we say when we know something that we understand it. That means it's as though we got under it and saw how it all works. But in theory of reality, it means what stands under all else and gives it its reality. What is it? What is it about the world that's the fundamental reality, that's the self-existent, that stands on its own and stands under and supports the existence of all the other things that are not self-existent? So they began to use the word substance. In ancient philosophy, pagans used substance for the divine. Later on, Christians used it for for the reality of whom they denied its divinity, but took it to explain how all things hang together. And by hang together, I don't mean something loosey-goosey. I'm referring now to the way all different kinds of parts and properties relate tightly and are in a law-governed organization in ordinary things all around us. How is that relation possible? We don't experience objects as loosey-goosey collections of properties or something. This pen, for example. We experience as a discrete individual thing. All of those parts and properties cohere to make it what it is, and the unity of them is powerful. We experience it as a unified individual. Okay, so look again at this. What is it? Christians took what pagans were calling substance, and they denied that it had divinity, but said it could be what hangs everything together. And that's why there's no Christian philosophy. Because no matter which part of the universe you pick to be the part that hangs everything together, as long as you add, and it in turn is created by God, you're not violating Christian principles. And my objection is, oh yes, you are. Colossians chapter 1 says not only that God created everything, all things visible and invisible, in heaven and in earth, principalities, powers, whatever it is, God created it. Through Christ, and in him all things hang together. That selection from creation as to what it is that's divine is wrong. But it's also wrong about what hangs all things together. That's only the power of God. And you get all these different theories because you choose all different candidates for what it is that hangs it all together. Is it matter plus logic? Or is it sensations plus logic? Or is it matter plus mathematics? Or maybe it's just matter. Or just sensations. Or maybe it's something else. This is what hangs it all together and makes the world of our experience to be what it is. And, by the way, makes us, because we're part of that world. There are no candidates that are the right ones. It's only God that goes in, that does that. So instead of getting some kind of created thing, and saying it's the substance that hangs all the things together. I mentioned some of the candidates. Some people have said it's matter and energy. There are people that have held that it's matter and energy plus mathematical laws. So it's matter and energy organized by mathematics. There have been people that have said, no, the reality we experience is nothing more than our sense perceptions. We can't know that those represent a world outside of us. All we know is what is our sensations plus the logic by which we reason about them. Okay, that's another. There are other people who try to say that it is space plus math. And that what we call space concentrates in certain parts. And when we get enough concentrated space, we call it matter. So infinite space spontaneously generates protons. That was the theory. And then we get collections of matter. They get bigger and bigger. And we get stars and we get galaxies and planets and so on. But what reality comes down to is infinite eternal, uncreated space as organized by eternal, uncreated mathematical laws. All God substitutes. It's my objection. And unfortunately, Descartes does not draw this distinction. And what Descartes does, when he talks about mind and body, he says that in this respect, humans, because they're a combination of mind and body, are a little microcosm, a microcosm, a little universe. Because in the big universe, what is substance is, and again, he thinks math and logic are about the same, is mathematical, logical principles and physical objects. And he calls these secondary substance. What's the primary substance? God, of course. God created them, right? But then they are what hangs all things together. So he's got the same explanation, or can have the same explanation, as anybody who doesn't believe in God, but still believes in the duality of human nature, the mind, the body, and the duality of principles in the world, the math logic, which is what the mind knows, and the physical, which is what the body perceives. Mind, the perception is registered in minds. So here is primary substance, and these he calls secondary. And that's just a way of saying, I'm a Christian, I believe in God, but I accept this dualistic explanation of the world that's the same whether I believe in God or I don't. He did try to drag God into the explanations of one or two parts of the theories, and we're going to come to that very shortly in the next lecture. But I want to say to you that he drags God in by the heels and just makes him paste over things that are otherwise impossible to get your head around, impossible to explain. And I'm urging you to reject this ploy for how to make theories and go instead with Christian versions that do not make any part of creation what all the rest depends on, or is organized by, or is hung together by, because that's only God, the Creator, who does it through Christ. Next time.